Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua. How you doing?
I am doing pretty good, actually. Although, dear listener or viewer, if you're watching this over on La Patreon, I do have a little bit of a sinus thing going on. So I sound a little stuffy, which I feel Joe can relate to. You also seem to be.
Yeah, I have a wee bit of a sore throat that I thought was sinusy related, but who knows?
You might have the COVID from the Black Lagoon.
Oh my gosh. It's the, it's like an It Follows. It finally got me. I gotta go have sex with someone now to keep that bay.
Oh man. Yeah, no, we got back from London, obviously, last week, as you well know, and somewhere along the way, we picked up something. Jeffrey's got a little something in his chest. Ooh. I've got a little something in my sinuses in my ear. Doesn't seem to be COVID, although, you know, I guess you never know with all the changing things going on.
I know. We're up to Ba 5 now. No longer yeah. Ba 2, so...
Yeah, so just kind of been keeping it low. The first couple days were really bad. Like my ear especially was like all closed up and it like hurt. I mean, there was there was a few hours on Wednesday, I think. Wednesday or Thursday. I think it was Wednesday that I was like, I should go to the hospital maybe. Because it was, I mean, the pain was so unbearable. Like I couldn't focus on anything. Mm-hmm. But because, you know, like the man I am, I was like, no, I'm just going to wait it out and see what happens. So now it's better. I think I actually, to be honest with you, I think it might be swimmer's ear. But who knows? But the more like I like, fiddled with my ear, the worse it got. So ever since I've just left it alone, it's getting better. So
I hear the little one.
Yeah, we've got Lily in here today. She is like refusing to like leave. I don't know, maybe I'm dying, Joe, who knows. Both of the cats been on me, so yeah, I don't know what's going on. Anyways, How have you been? Well, first of all, thank you so much for once again holding down the fort here at the West Craven Memorial Library whilst we globetrotted.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. What's really amazing is how clean the house was. Like, I'm like, you know, because we do a lot of stuff. So people come and go when we're here. We have visitors. We have like the weekly, you know, watches and stuff. And so the house can be kind of messy within a week or two. And I was like, wow, it looks like all fresh and clean. So thank you. Everything was perfect.
Ah, the plan is working. the plan worked. Did you see the towels?
I did. You folded them correctly.
Oh my gosh. When James came over, he was like, he looked at the towels and he was laughing at me because I got so mad about like, I don't know what he's talking about. and then before when I was, you know, I wanted to treat the little ones to like a warm blanket right before I left. So I did the blankets and I, you know, ran them through and I also did some towels. And then I took one out and I examined it. And then I did it that way. In the spirit of this science fiction film we're going to talk about, like I examined it.
There we go. You got scientific on it.
Yeah, I did.
I actually like that. I appreciate that, you know, because that's what I would do. Like if I was staying somewhere, I'd be like, well, how do they do, you know?
And you're going to love this part. I got to say, I like the way you fold your towels better than the way I fold them. I think you could fit more. I don't know how that's possible.
Thing.
I don't know how that's possible, though.
This house was built in the 50s, so the closet's really narrow. And so it's like, we have to fold them a certain way so that everything fits. Because you have, like, your big towels, your hand towels, your, like, washcloths, face cloths, whatever people call them. The square one, the rectangular one, and the big rectangle ones. So it's like, they all have to be folded a certain way to fit. So anyways, this is endlessly fascinating, as always. For those listening, I just want to say I appreciate it. And if you ever get the pleasure of Joe watching your house, you can 5 stars on Yelp. Wonderful. For me.
Thank you.
On TripAdvisor. Anyways, it's been a pretty good week being back. We did a ton of stuff in London. Obviously, we saw the ABBA Voyage show was incredible.
Can you explain what that is? So it wasn't ABBA.
No. Well, it's ABBA, but not really ABBA. So it's like CGI digital. Like it's beyond hologram, I would say. Like it's not like a hologram, which is usually like an image like projected on stage. You know, this was like they had big screens and they created these like 3-dimensional looking avatars, the avatars. And so it's like them performing music like in they made them younger. They're like, I think it's like the 70s, late 70s kind of look for all of them. Mm-hmm. There's a 10-piece live band, including singers, you know, a full band. And then they use, I'm pretty sure they use, although this, I'm kind of confused about this myself. They use the original album vocals to do the songs. But they have a ton of live stuff. So I'm actually surprised they didn't record live or use like live sampled vocals. But otherwise, there was a lot of live music going on. And so they built this thing out in Pudding Mill Lane in London, out in the middle of nowhere. They built this giant arena to house all of this stuff. Oh, man, I wish I had it in here now. So I bought one of the programs that kind of talked about like 64 million pixels, you know, in this, you know, total in all the screens, you know, 800 light fixtures, you know, hundreds of miles of ropes and cables and all that kind of stuff. It kind of broke down like what it takes to do the show. And so, yeah, and if it, I don't know how many, you know what, to be honest, Jeffrey and I kept comparing it to the Charles M. Schultz Theater at Knott's Berry, like where we saw Elvira. Like that's how it's not huge. It was a pretty small space, to be honest. But they used all of it. Like there were lights all around the whole thing. The screens went like way onto the sides, like kind of enveloped the arena. They had all this stuff like coming down, no matter where you sat, there were things coming down from the ceiling and up and, you know, all that. We had dance floor tickets. So they have kind of like a giant, they have the arena with like arena style seating all around. And then in the middle is just a big open, you know, GA pit. So that's where we were, which was great. So anyway, so that's basically what it is. You're kind of watching this digital version of ABBA perform their songs live, quote unquote. But it felt like, I mean, you really kind of bought into it like we did. Like, you know, I mean, when they first came out, it was very uncanny valley where you're like, okay, I get what they're doing. Still cool. But as it went on, you kind of got a little lost in it. And there were definitely moments where it's like, man, I can't believe they're not like real people up there, you know, just because the screens, like they would show, it was just all really well done, all really well coordinated. So like it was like being at a concert sometimes where they'd have like the video screens. So it'd be like images of them on the stage, but it was all like perfectly in sync. You know, and then they would get close-ups and it's like, you know, just the little wispy hairs, like, you know, floating and which I just thought that was really incredible. And I keep talking about how like in between songs, they kind of like would hang out on the stage and like Bjorn, who's the guitarist, he would be kind of wavering, you know, like you would if you were on stage waiting for the next song to start and that and your guitar's heavy, like it just felt really real. You really kind of got lost in the whole image of it. And the audience too. I mean, they lost their minds. It was really like ABBA was up there. So, and it wasn't that the whole time. There was a lot of videos. I mean, it was like, kind of like when you go to any pop concert and there's like video interludes, there was stuff like that. There were times when like the avatars would do other things. And so they'd be like, you know, huge in the stadium, or, you know, they played with the format. It wasn't like they just stood on stage and like sang the whole time, you know, like there, it was very, very immersive and interactive. A lot of stuff going on. Super cool. Highly recommend. I hope they come to Vegas. You know, I mean, it's like, I think that'd be perfect if they opened up this in like Vegas would be a good place for it, because it kind of needs to be built. I don't think it's the kind of thing you could easily travel with unless you got into venues where you had like control over every aspect. Because like the lighting, it has to be really dark. You know, it has to be, a lot of stuff has to work, you know? So it only makes sense for them to like build something in LA or build something in Las Vegas or New York in order to make it, you know, work.
Yeah, you... I'm actually really surprised that you're raving about it, considering, I mean, like, you and Jeffrey see like a ton of live music, and to have this experience where it's like, it's live, but not really, but, I mean, it's really stepping into the future. It sounds like.
Yeah. I just think, it was just unlike anything we'd seen before, which we're always looking for that in live performance and shows. You know, when we saw Bjork do, you know, Cornucopia, that was like at the time the, you know, most mind-blowing thing. Once she gets a hold of this technology, oh my gosh, I can't imagine the Bjork like, avatar show, because she could really work with it. Madonna, I think, could really work with it. I do think that the key to making this work so well is that ABBA is still alive and we're very much involved. They spent several weeks, like 5 weeks or something, with all the little dots on their faces wearing the suits, so they could like translate all their moves, which they then like, you know, digitally grafted on to like younger bodies, but like the movements are all very natural to them, the way they sing, the way they talk, you know, their eyes, all of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it was just very, very detailed, and because they were there, and then they recorded like new stuff. So each of the members was like highlighted for a song. It would like tell a little story and then go into a song, and that helped that was new. So I know a lot of people are talking about like, oh, you know, they could do this for Michael Jackson or Whitney Houston. But it's like the fact that they're alive and involved in it, I think, adds something. I think you'd really lose something if, I mean, who knows? I mean, the technology keeps getting better and better. So who knows what people might do. But I don't think it would work as well to try to do this with like a dead celebrity.
I think that what you said about like having the live person's input, like, you ever watch Dollhouse with Eliza Dushku?
I saw some episodes of it, but when it was like new, my brother's and sister's father was obsessed with it.
It's kind of this, where it's just like, okay, these people are gonna like, in the future, quote unquote, very Black Mirror, the digital consciousness will be downloaded of a celebrity, and they'll work until they're dead. They'll work until they're irrelevant anymore, right? Like, even in death, like, that's the thing that like I really didn't like about like holograms showing up at Coachella of like Whitney Houston and Tupac. It's like, even in death, they can't find any rest or peace. Like, you know, if, yeah, it's interesting. And I know that that's totally a thing right now too. It's like, you know, celebrities, what happens to their digital image after their passing, and who can and cannot make money off of that. I feel like this is a way to like, you know, ensure some sort of continuity and like, you know, continued support for their descendants, right? But it's just so strange, because like, think about this in like the, you know, 30, 40 years, it's like, if something happens to Beyonce, is there already something in the works for Cher? Like, I could see this being like a Cher thing, and you could,
oh yeah, Cher, yeah, would be great. Yeah, any like of the pop stuff, I think, would really work, because that's the thing. This blended a lot of that. There were times where you felt like you were in a music video. There were times that it was like super immersive. They built this film that was kind of split into two parts, between a song called Eagle and Voulez-Vous, and ABBA songs. Still talking about ABBA. And it was really neat. It was like a video game. It was kind of this person, this traveler, like, you know, hunting down something or whatever. Felt very Indiana Jones in a way, but they was very, they looked not Viking like, but something. It was just their own thing. So it kind of blended a lot of things. So I think it works best. It would work best with that kind of, you know, because people were saying, like, afterwards we were chatting with people, they're like, oh, it'd be cool if, like, the Rolling Stones did this, or Led Zeppelin, or, you know, the, you know, all these kind of guys. And it's like, I don't know if it would work as well. I mean, maybe, you know, the Beatles, somebody said, oh, that'd be cool to do this for the Beatles. And it's like, yeah, but they just kind of stand there and play music, right? Yeah. It's not a show, you know, so this is something that, like, it works really well pop wise because there's a lot of imagery. And so, not to say that they couldn't do it with the Beatles. Certainly there's plenty to dig in there, yeah. Especially like Yellow Submarine and, you know, Sergeant Pepper. Like, there's a lot of visual imagery that they could make something really interesting out of them. I have no doubt. I mean, they've got a whole musical they could, like, base stuff off of, you know, but yeah, I don't know. It was just something beyond, like, It way was beyond my expectations of what I expected it to be. And I can't wait to see how it evolves and how it changes. And I do really hope that they tour it, because I would love to see it again. We tried, actually. We looked for tickets again, just because it's really, like, sold out. It's really, really hard to get seats. We actually bought resale tickets that somebody was happening to sell.
Oh, and, nice. Nice.
Yeah. And we got lucky because they were not overly expensive. I don't know if there's, like, a control or something there. You know, kind of like what the Foo Fighters are doing with their Taylor Hawkins tribute. It's tightly controlled. And even the resale, it has to be, like, through their site or something, and you can't make money off of it. It has to be original face value ticket. So I don't know. Maybe there's something at play there. So we got super lucky, but we tried to go again because it was cool. It was really cool. So that's it. So now that we've talked for a half an hour about ABBA, I guess we can just, I recommend it if people want to go see it. Other than that, obviously the rest of London was super cool. Saw lots of museums, did all that, did a Jack the Ripper tour. I'm not going to talk too much about that because the guy who did the tour wrote a book that I picked up, and I do think that we might be able to get him to come and chat with us. So I don't want to get too into the weeds with the Jack the Ripper stuff, but it was super cool.
Okay.
Caught up on Stranger Things up till the last two that just came out.
Oh my God, Joshua.
We're through the seven. So we watched a ton of Stranger Things on the flight. It was so cute though, because we both had our iPads where we had downloaded everything, because we hadn't watched season three yet. So we had downloaded season three and season four. And so we kept, like, looking at each other and syncing our iPads so that we played them at the same time so that we could, like, you know, make faces and point at things. Cause we couldn't watch together, on one iPad.
So are we thinking that, like, I mean, I just cannot stop looking at Maya Hawke and thinking they had, like, Gattaca is real. Gattaca is real. She is a clone of Uma Thurman.
Like, oh, I know. Even her voice, the way she talks.
Even her voice. I'm like, I was just like, if we don't get, like, a Gattaca remake with Maya Hawke, or like what we've been talking about, or Quentin Tarantino's talked about, where it's like Kill Bill 3, but it's like the bride. It's Beatrix Kiddo's, like, daughter who is, like, fighting against Vernita Green's daughter, like that whole thing. Oh my gosh. Like, she is gorgeous, and the spitting image of her mother, and, like, It's very much like that celebrity app where it's like, here, put two pictures together and this is what their baby looks like. That's, like, how Maya Hawke comes out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We were laughing about that because there was something she did or said in one of the things. I was like, oh, that was so Uma. Like, she just looks just like her and sounds like her. And, you know, even the cadence, the way that she talks, it's like you can really hear that she grew up with Uma Thurman. But yeah, otherwise, like, the season's been fun. It's very Nightmare on Elm Street, which I'm enjoying very much in that kind of realm. Also, a lot of other things. It's inspiring, you know. Obviously, there's, like, Carrie references in there, and
Silence of the Lambs, like, a very heavy-handed, like, not even homage, like quite literally a shot-for-shot remake.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That was entertaining. So I'm overall enjoying like the aesthetics of it and the fun. The story is super convoluted as always. And very like, there were times we kind of stopped between episodes. Like, what the fuck is going on? What is happening? There's like a lot happening, but you know, getting to that seventh episode and kind of, you know, twisting things together, some stuff we guessed kind of knew along the way. You know, I was like, oh, I think that this or that. And then it was like, that is, you know, that came to pass. I'm like, well, there you go. Yeah. So super fun though. And it's fun to actually be kind of caught up with everybody and, you know, avoiding spoilers too much. I mean, obviously you can't escape the running up that hill conversation that's been happening the last few weeks, which again, go Kate Bush. So happy for her. Love that people are discovering her. The only thing is, last time we were watching it, and like she was playing "Running Up That Hill" again. I'm like, there are other songs on that album, my friend, that maybe you want to check out. but I also get like licensing and all that. Maybe they just could have. But there's, you know, it's a great album. So I hope that you know, I hope Kate Bush is swimming in it and enjoying it.
I saw an article this morning that like since season 4 came out, she's made over $2.3 million in streaming revenue, which like is
amazing
considering like how pennies you get for streaming shit.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's on everything too. It's like, you can't open TikTok. Every single video is using some part of "Running Up That Hill." And some of it makes no sense. I'm like, why is this song in this video of a cat, like, you know, knocking over a cup? Like, I don't know what's happening, but it's everywhere. Which part of me is like, that's great and wonderful, but I do hate our culture's tendency to do that, you know, and like, they're just going to run it into the ground. And I'm not looking forward to the articles next, you know, in a couple of months or next year, you know, like, is "Running Up That Hill" actually a good song? Did it deserve the, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to have that kind of, like, oh, it was so funny. I saw this person tweeted out about they were like, am I the only person that hates Eddie? And then they went on this whole thing about how like everything about him is like corporately designed to like appeal and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, his hair and his jacket and everything. He's just like, the whole thing is like, it seems so an effort just to pull like a very specific nostalgia string. And I wanted to tweet back at them. Like, it's very interesting that this whole tweet seems to be totally created to just generate likes and conversation. Cause yeah, you're like the only person that's like talking about hating Eddie. Like, it's so contrarian. It's like, I don't think this person cares one way or the other, but it's a perfect time to like post something like that. Like right now, somebody should go on and just be like, I hate Kate Bush, you know, just because it would generate. I'm not saying they should, actually. I shouldn't say that. No, we don't need more negativity, but it's just the contrarianism of it all cracks me up, you know. Yeah. Just know there are people out there. Kate Bush isn't that talented, you know?
Eddie is very histrionic, but I think he needs to be that way in order to pull the very specific thing. Also, the thing that I was not appreciative of, this is not a spoiler, but I was like, okay, like we're really like checking the list off of all of the 80s cultural thing conversations, right? Like,
right,
like this whole season was about fucking Satanic Panic, like, and I'm like, oh my totally. Gosh, like we're really checking this off. And I was just like, okay, we get it. And part of me just thinks like, huh, interesting. I wonder if I would love to like just sit down for like dinner or brunch or something with the Duffer Brothers to just unpack their mind, because the storytelling is really interesting. And Joshua, the last two episodes pull the entire series together.
Yeah.
And I think it was designed that. Sure. I think it was designed that way. But
I just think the whole series does that though. Like, that's the thing, like being critical of, again, I don't care either way. Like, I'm not extremely invested in Stranger Things, like as a property, and I'm not going to like defend it or, you know, people hate stuff. Like that's perfectly fine. My commentary was more about just how quickly, you know, it's like when people love something, you've got to have those people out there that hate it. And a lot of times I feel it's just to generate conversation or to generate shares and likes, but it's always done that 80s, you know. I just remember the very first season, like that first episode, you know, opening up in these like brown wood houses, like, you know, the wood and like the tab and, you know, the just, it was so like, we're in the 80s, but a very like a different, like not the 80s we're used to seeing glamorized. This was like, it's the fucking 80s. Like there are times when these characters, like poor Nancy, the clothing they put that girl in, I'm just like, you poor thing. Like, cause, but she looks, I mean, I remember people dressing like that. Like I remember, you know, in the early 90s, especially in 90, 91, like people still kind of look like that, you know, in Ohio.
Yeah. Oh, like an accordion skirt and a shoulder pad. Like,
yes. Like there were just things about it that I'm like, it's so real, you know, it's so much the 80s. But again, there is a lot of nostalgia porn in it as well. And like, that's fine. Again, like if people are enjoying themselves, whatever, but yeah. Anyways, it's just, our culture is so interesting to me. Did you watch anything new this week or?
I don't know if you noticed in your streaming, in your streamer services, but I watched quite a bit of things. At a certain point I was like literally trying to intentionally fuck up your algorithm by watching most random shit. I think your YouTube's all fucked. But yeah, I mean, I feel
you'd
like
be surprised the level of darkness, it overtook it right back. So the only thing I noticed was because you must have watched Trixie Mattel and Drag Race on my thing, because it wasn't in my queue to watch.
I did.
So I had to actually search for it so that we could watch the new episodes. But that's all I really noticed. Yeah, that's all I've noticed so far.
I finished the Umbrella. I felt like here's the list of the things that I finished. I finished the Umbrella Academy.
Nice.
I watched it from the beginning again in anticipation of the final season or the next season. And it was very like, it's very much like a Stranger Things where like it's like the needle drops are really great. The story is just as convoluted. You really don't quite know what's happening, but people love it. I watched the Jennifer Lopez documentary, which I found oddly riveting. I think it's a different side of J-Lo that we are not used to seeing. Not that like, you know, she's this huge public personality, but it was really cool and refreshing to see her talk about not only her career and like what it was like to be like, you know, a Latina in Hollywood at the time and when she was starting to rise. I binged watched season 3 of Legendary, which was fantastic. Like I was literally doing like, you know, walks for the cats and, you know, just be like, come on, Hemlock, give me that cut. And
you're
just
a mess.
Yeah, totally mess. And most recently, I started from the beginning, I started watching The Boys on Amazon, because I know that the next season is just released its season finale. And I've always kind of wanted to watch The Boys. So I started, and it's good, but like it's so I think it's interesting to me that like the two shows on Amazon that I love, which are like The Boys and Upload, are both like huge indictments about like monster corporations. And it's like the self-awareness or the audacity that it takes for like Amazon to two really popular shows be specifically about like how awful big corporations are.
Well, it's always fascinating when they tell on themselves, or again, it's like Fox News by day, Fox Network by night, or two very different things. You know, we all flock to the Hunger Games and, you know, Harry Potter and, you know, Divergent, whatever, and say, this is exactly the world we're living in, and then continue, you know, to behave as if we can't change it and that everything is futile, whatever I'm trying to say.
It's fascinating.
Anyways.
Yeah. Futile.
Futility of it all. Well, it sounds like you had a really good watch week. You've been like conquering shit.
I mean, like, it was also just like fun to just be with the cats and like have them, you know, claw at me and sit on me. And, you know, I got like, I like fully understand the geography of like Lilium's vagina. Like, she's just like in my face. And then she started speaking. Nice. Which was interesting because, like, I don't usually hear from her unless we shush her. And then there were times where she started speaking, and I was like, what is going on? What is she saying? You know, what is she all about?
Just chattering away.
And I was like, do you need something? You're usually the quiet one. It's Hemlock's the one who, like, has everything to say.
Yeah. No, it's funny. She does. Especially, like, you do get to know her more when you stay, you know, because she's very chatty. And nobody ever knows why. Like, you get up, you follow her around. She just walks in circles. She's not trying. She just wants to make noise.
He was like, Hemlock was like,
she's like me in that way.
Would just like follow me and just be like, meh, meh. And I just had to like, I always had to not have my back to him when I was filling up my water, because he's going to jump on me. And I'm like, I'm not like your daddy's. Like, you jump on me. Like, it's like, I read enough Calvin and Hobbes to know.
There you go. Yeah. They're rude. good times.
Awesome.
Yay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we will wrap it up here and take a quick break. And then we're going to be back to talk about the creature from the Black Lagoon. Yay.
Hey, dear listener, Joshua here with a plug for our Patreon. Becoming a Fright School patron will give you the opportunity for exclusive access to bonus content, including videos, our secret show, book club, and even monthly online hangouts with us. That's right, we've been hard at work preparing all of this exciting content for you, including our brand new secret show, the After Fright School Special. Joe finally gets his revenge by making me watch his favorite films. Some of them will even be gag family friendly. We have four different monthly memberships available. The PTA Booster Club at $1, Just Auditing at $5, Full Time Load at $10, and the Faculty Lounge at $20. Every bit helps us keep Fright School going, and we are so grateful for any and all of your support. Join us over at patreon.com/frightschool. The class you never want to miss just got better.
All right. Welcome back. Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited. I'm so, so, so excited for today's chat. It has taken us many years. I have, to get to Creature from the Black Lagoon, even though it is like one of my favorites of the Universal monster films. And I, you know, it was just one of those things where it's like, I think I put this on and taken it off and put it on, taken it off, trying to find exactly where I wanted to place it. You know, because we were doing sort of the fairy tale dive. So for a while, I thought we would do like a Beauty and the Beast thing. And mm-hmm. We could talk about, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon and King Kong and, you know, those sorts of things. But I don't know. It just seemed like the perfect time for this summer, you know, for July to do our little series here of, you know, don't go in the water. Don't go outside at all is my general motto. But for this little segment, we're looking at some films about watery monster creature things. So got to start with Creature from the Black Lagoon. And obviously I'm very excited. You see, I've got my Creature from the Black Lagoon shirt on. That's,
yes.
You know, if you're watching us, you can see that. I did my nails all green. I've got my Creature from the Black Lagoon tiki mug with I'm using my glass Coco Peru straw, because Coco Peru, this is actually cool. She sent me a message on Instagram, because I posted a picture and she said, that's my childhood crush. And we had a little back and forth about Creature from the Black Lagoon. which I knew because she did a stand-up show, or like her one-woman show, a couple of years ago. It was the show, it was kind of infamous because she decided to change her wig, which if you know anything about Coco Peru, she's a famous drag queen, but Jackie B calls her old one wig because she's always had the same red little flip hair. She's in, if you've seen Don't Tell Mom, or no, To Wong Fu, Don't Tell Mom, the babysitter's a drag queen. To Wong Fu, thanks for everything. Julie Newmar, she's the drag queen in the big opening sequence who like walks down the runway and crushes the cup. And, you know, so that's Coco Peru. Anyway, she's a big fan of Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I thought it was appropriate today for having my beverage with us, with her glass straw. You know, I'm using Coco Peru to suck out of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Very lascivious. Anyways, 1954, classic. It just is. It's a classic film. Black and white, 3D. We've got Jack Arnold on direction, who also did It Came from Outer Space, I think. Screenplay, Harry Essex, Arthur Ross. Story, Maurice Zim. You know, who cares about them? We've got Richard Carlson starring Julia Adams, Richard Denning, which, little trivia for those, you know, maybe some people know this, but Richard Denning was the original husband on, I think he was the original husband. Maybe he was, maybe he came in at a different time. But anyways, My Favorite Husband, the radio show with Lucille Ball, which became I Love Lucy. He was the original husband on the radio show version. I thought that was cool trivia for people if they wanted to know. I've actually known that for a long time because I rented a book from the library when I was like 12 or 13. That was the Lucille like radio show. It was all about like her time in radio, and it had a CD with it that had episodes of My Favorite Husband on it. And it was with Richard Denning as Mr. and Mrs. Cougat, eventually Mr. and Mrs. Cooper. Anyways, little side thing there for the Lucille Ball-ologists, you know, among us.
This and has then, been of course, a public service announcement for your local library, you know.
Yes,
fun,
exactly.
Having fun isn't hard if you've got a library card.
Jell-O, everybody. The big red letter. No, the big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. Anyways, that's from My Favorite Husband. Anyways, blah, blah. We've gotten so off track already. Anyways, Ben Chapman and Riku Browning played the Gill Man, one on land, Chapman, and one underwater, Browning, which obviously the creature shines, I think, most when he's swimming along. Anyways, film, pretty standard plot, kind of ripped right from King Kong, which we'll discuss when we discuss King Kong later this year. Haha, spoiler alert, that is coming. You know, group scientists go to the Amazon, look at fossils, stumble across, you know, fish man monster. Hilarity ensues. Joe, what you think of The Creature from the Black Lagoon?
I don't want to upset you, Joshua. I thought it was what it was.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite film of the older films that we've watched. But it was definitely one of the longer ones. No,
what are you talking about? It's like 70 minutes. It's how 79 minutes, not even an hour and a half.
It moves fast.
It moves quick.
I mean, it does move fast. I didn't particularly care for it. But again, I also like, you know, I wanted. It was missing something and I wanted more, and I don't know how to describe it. It's also like, you know, a year before my parents were born, like this movie came out. So, so, you know, yeah. I don't want to go too far into it because it's just like, it's not worth it. I just can't really describe what it is that I didn't like about it. I loved everything that was not the researchers, so only the creature stuff. So creature coming out, you know, a lot of underwater swimming, all of that stuff. Like, I loved everything with the creature, hated everything with the researchers. I was like, stop talking. Stop talking. And the whole time I was thinking about watching this film, I was like, oh my God, this would be like the perfect like symphonic listen or movie for like a symphony.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah.
Like a Halloween thing.
Live. Yeah, that'd be really, really cool. Yeah, no, I mean, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Lord knows. We've watched enough stuff. But, and it's not that I don't disagree, you know, or not that I, you know, don't agree with you is what I mean to say. It's not that I disagree. You know, it's not a perfect film by any means. I think what I love about it is that I've always really enjoyed the creature design. Mm-hmm. You know, there are parts of it that are quite beautiful. You know, I mean, there are some swimming sequences that are just amazing. You know, obviously the very famous one of Julia Adams as Kay swimming and the creature swims up under her. And I mean, that's like super influential in film. And, you know, a lot of people saw that, you know, Guillermo del Toro famously, you know, that stuck with him, and seeing this film is why he made Shape of Water, because he wanted the creature and Kay to get together in the end. So he re-envisioned it so that he could make that film. But yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot of lofty goals in it that it doesn't really meet, which I think is what makes it kind of disappointing, especially when it comes to Kay, because she's very... So we're going to kind of look at this film from three different angles. So we might as well just, you know, since I already kind of started, we'll talk a little bit about the feminism of it, or lack of feminism, but the attempts at feminism. You know, then we're going to look a little bit, horror noir obviously had something to say about this, and it's covered in the documentary and in the textbook. And then also Monsters in the Closet mentions this with sort of a queer reading that I think is kind of interesting. So we'll just start with like the feminist angle, because I think that there's some really neat things like right off the bat. And it was funny because I made a note about Kay driving the boat, and which I read in several articles pointing out, like, you know, in the 50s, especially if there was a man available to drive, he'd be driving. You know, so the fact that she like is driving the boat on the way back as the scientists are chatting, you know, I think is a kind of a cool moment. It's clear that David like leans on her. There's mentions through, you know, in the film later about her valuable contribution to the work that they're doing and the research. Like, so obviously Kay's not meant to be like your standard, you know, woman in distress who just happens to be there. But obviously as the film goes on,
She becomes that.
Yeah, it's like the defunct, you know, role or whatever is like to, you know, stand around screaming while the creature, you know, grabs her. But again, that's, you know, unfortunately, especially for the time. And even now, I mean, again, like women still, like there are so many problems with like the representations of women and female scientists. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, what's her name? Caitlin. I love her. What's her last name? Caitlin. She does these like minute videos or whatever, where it's like, you know, Wasp Mom goes to Olive Garden or whatever. But she has one where it's like women, every woman scientist in a movie. And it's just always like, you know, I'm a woman and a scientist, but I can't really be both. Or like, you know, I'm either I'm in khaki or I'm in camo. There's no other choice. Like, it's just, so there are things. There are attempts to make Kay, at least in the beginning of the film, like, I mean, she's very involved in the conversation. Like when they're talking about the fossilized like hand they find, she's the one who mentions like, oh, it looks like this is made for land. And so it's like clear that she's meant to be intelligent and meant to be part of the conversation. It's not like the guys ignore her. She's giving important, you know, stuff at the beginning to the film. And contributing scientifically, quote unquote, I mean, as sciencey as this movie gets, as scientifically accurate as this film is. I had to look up the Devonian period because I kept saying it. I'm like, what is that? But it's the time where we believe that like amphibious creatures became like, or water creatures moved to the land, that evolutionary period. Yeah, but in the end, she just ends up being the damsel in distress. But I was curious what your thoughts, because I remember in the very first season when we watched The Thing from Another World, we kind of had a similar conversation. We were talking about the Hays Code and the, I should have looked this up, the something woman. Remember? We had like a whole...
Femme Fatale?
Femme Fatale, I remember, but... I think we had to do with like the woman in that is kind of similar where it's like, anyways, never mind. If it didn't, I thought it would ignite your Hays Code brain.
Oh, Joshua, you give me so much credit. well, if you find it, let's bring it back up. But I mean, here's the thing: like
the Hawks woman or something.
Oh, the Howard Hawks woman. Oh, with His Girl Friday, where she's just like this kind of like, you know, equal footing antagonist. Oh my God, what is her name? Famous Cary Grant movie, His Girl Friday. Who is that woman?
Well, like Katherine Hepburn, Anne Dvorak, Ava Gardner, Rosalind Russell, Barbara Stanwyck, blah, 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 Lauren Bacall, Hawksian woman.
The Hawksian woman.
Up front and speaking her mind and keeping up with her male counterparts in witty banter, as well as taking action to get what she wants personally, as well as sexually.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Kay totally fits into this, but it was something that I was thinking of when I was thinking about, like, because I think The Thing from Another World also came out in 54 or around there, 1951.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it just kind of, as I was watching it, I was thinking about that Hawksian woman caricature, that archetype, I mean, not character, archetype that we had discussed and... You see, know, the Hays Code of it all.
But here's the thing, like a Hawksian woman, like what took me out of this and where I started to hate all of the people in the film besides the creature is when...
Again, maybe the point. We'll get there.
Totally, maybe the point. When Kate like just goes swimming in the lagoon, like the scene that you just mentioned, I was like, she's just like, you know, doing synchronized swimming and it's just like in like... First of all, if we're going to a place called the Black Lagoon, why would, like, let's just, like, go swimming in there?
Well, the guys are doing their diving and their deep dive and they're exploring. So I just think it's like she wants to get in on the action.
Yeah, but, like, at least with the, they were doing it in pairs. You know, there was a scientific purpose.
No,
she was just, like, this leisurely swim. And for me, it was, like, it was not so much, like, I don't want anyone to read into any misogyny of like, you know, silly woman goes, you know, but like, I was like, come on, white woman. Like, it's the black, I'm going to go swim in the Black Lagoon. I mean, like, I'm going to go jump off a, you know, dead man's pier or something like that. Like what was the point of that? And that's when I started to like really, and also she's like doing these motions and it was very like, I went to prep school and this is what I learned in my calisthenics course. So, you know, we did swimming.
I like what she's doing, the little loops, you
yes,
know,
which I know wasn't her.
Perfect.
It was someone else that did the, I read, it was like someone else who did the underwater stunts for her. So it was another woman swimming, but like, still, it's just like,
but we within to look, the character.
Exactly. Yeah. We need it to look pretty. We need it to look like remind her that she just, you know, is a woman.
Well, and I think that's exactly it. Again, if they had given it, you know, like she's like, I'm going to swim over to that outcrop over there and see what I find, you know, and doing like researchy things, sciencey things, it maybe would have made, you know, would have added, you know, a depth to that scene for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause otherwise it is, that's the point of that scene, is to serve as like the enticement of the creature and like, ah, you know, like this is why I should like stick around and, you know, check out what's happening here. This beautiful, you know, white woman swimming around in the Amazon jungle, you know?
Immediately understand, like immediately appreciate Jaws more. Because it's such, it's so referenced in Jaws. Like, and I was just like, wow, this is where they got it. Like, that's been really fun to also, as we, one thing that I love about revisiting these older films is to see where the references originate. And how they, like, where it's like, we're referencing it, we're paying homage to it, and then where our scene is now also iconic as well. Like, it's just, it was really cool. And just like the playfulness of the creature where it's just like, I'm going to tickle your feet. I'm going to tickle your feet. Oh, I'm like, ooh, a claw got you. Oh, but not so much. Like, it was just very like a cat, like pawing at something. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not, it's very, very weird that those sequences where he's just like trying to touch her, but not exactly. Yeah. That's I don't know. It's very strange to me. So like what the creature is trying to do. But yeah, I agree there. Like, I love those sequences because they're extremely, again, this is early, you know, in 1954, 53 that they're shooting it or whatever, or early 54. I can't remember. Actually, yeah, it must've been 53. Cause I think it came out in March of 54, right? Mm, it's mm-hmm. official release date. So yeah, they would have been, filming it still the year before. But it's, and the sequence is gorgeous, you know, I mean, it's just such a beautiful, and like what an accomplishment for that time for filming underwater and the way the creature moves in the suit. I mean, again, this just goes to say something about like the beautiful makeup and the beautiful creature design that's in here. And again, that was the other point I was going to make about kind of the feminist reading of the film is like, you know, the important thing to remember is that like I just finished Mallory O'Meara's The Lady from the Black Lagoon, which is our first Fright School book club pick. So again, make sure you are joined into our Patreon so you can join us for the Zoom chat that we're going to have about the film. You know, it's called Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Spoiler alert, the Hollywood monsters are all the terrible white men that haunted and continue to haunt the big movie studios. So Millicent Patrick, the book was so good. I don't know if you got a chance to read it yet, Joe. I know that you were trying, but you had misplaced the copy that you had.
Yeah, I need to find it because it's a signed copy too. So yeah. I wonder if I put it in storage with my other signed books, but
yeah,
maybe. I will have to find it.
Yeah, because it was very, very good. A lot about her life, about Millicent Patrick, you know, how she became one of the first women to animate at Disney, and then how she went on and you know, designed all these things and sort of, you know, her legacy had gotten lost because Bud Westmore's piece of garbage, you know, trash, took kind of credit and dismissed her over his own jealousy. I mean, the book does such a good job of going into it because she had like letters and, you know, Mallory got all of this really great, like, you know, first person accounts of what happened. And, you know, they had all this stuff saved, all these memos and things about, you know, discussing Bud and discussing Millicent and the whole thing with Creature. You know, so there's this whole other element that's also going on where you know, the film, I do think for the time was trying to, you know, bolster Kay and put her kind of in this situation where she was, you know, seems a very much an individual woman, very independent. You know, she's in this relationship, but she doesn't really need to be. Mm-hmm. She's not, I don't think she's really dependent on either of these men to some degree. She feels fealty to Mark because he, you know, was a researcher and helped get her job, but he obviously needs her. There's a whole conversation, like I said later, about her own important things. But so anyway, so that's going on screen. And then, you know, the backdrop is that, you know, the woman who designed, you know, the creature, and again, who did she, and the book is very, very much points out that it was a team effort. You know, she did the designs for it, but you know, somebody else sculpted it. Somebody else, you know, applied the makeups and did those sorts of things, but she was there on set painting and, you know, and so there's just this really, really, for how, I don't even know how many times I've seen this film and seen it discussed and talked about over the years, to know that there was this like horrible thing that happened, you know, in the background, you know, behind the scenes, that ruined a very promising career. I mean, she should have been a household name, you know. I mean, she was for a while because she toured, and Millicent toured with the designs and all this.
She should have been the Greg Nicotero of her time.
So, you know, because people say, oh, we don't really know the names of behind the scenes people, but we do. We know Tom Savini. We know Rick Baker. You know, we know these like famous monster makers. And I think she should have been up there with them, especially because she did a lot of other really
Mick
cool
Garris ones. Does he count?
I mean, he's a director, writer.
Director,
I guess.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. I mean, again, we know some people, but I think she's somebody that we should have known. People should have known a lot earlier. And again, some people did. It was just sort of one of those things that was a little lost to history and clouded by time. So the book does a really good job about you know, uncovering this really cool legacy and all the other interesting things that this woman did with her life. She lived at Hearst Castle and, you know, kind of lived there at, when she was a child. Her father like designed and did all this work on Hearst Castle. His legacy also was lost to time because he was kind of an asshole. So people willfully forgot him. So there you go. People be nice. Be nice to people so that they don't erase your name from all the great work you might do. I mean, it's just the truth. It's something that she worked hard on in the last bit of her life because her father died and nobody knew that he had, you know, done this thing. So anyway, so there's just a lot of really interesting behind the scenes stuff. So I highly recommend the book. And it just gave me a really new perspective on Creature from the Black Lagoon. And also I learned a lot about Hollywood at that time and, you know, things, stuff is such garbage and it's been garbage for so long. So we have to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we'll move on to discuss a little from horror noir. So they point out, and again, I think this is why that scene is so important, because this is another one of those movies, much like King Kong gets a very similar reading, where the monster is like after the, you know, the woman, specifically the white woman, and you know, she must be protected at all costs and we must like destroy, you know, the creature. He's got to be, you know, he's got to be destroyed. And that this film like taps into, I mean, something that was kind of very common at the time, you know, these fears of segregation, fears of, I can never say this word, miscegenation, you know, the blending of, you know, so horror noir, you know, they discuss the film, they discuss the way the creature looks, you know, his lips, for instance, you know, they kind of compare him a bit to like the minstrel sort of look, and that he obviously stands in, you know, this is the Dr. Robin Coleman. I'm actually referencing the book, you know, but just talking about the way that he looks, that he's racially positioned, especially like being, you know, in the Amazon, and you know, there's a conversation happening there, and that the creature sort of represents like that menace. But it's interesting because the creature isn't, he's not like malevolent. Like, I don't think it, like, he's just this, or they, I mean, we don't even really know what the Gill Man is, but I guess, you know, context clues with
Gill person.
You know, we say refer to him as he's a man. He's a creature, like just doing his own business. Like, he's just in his place, not asking to be bothered. You know, these people, even in the beginning, like, you know, when he's going, he's sort of like examining the camp, and then of course, you know, kills those workers because they throw a lamp at him. So he attacks, and you know, he's self-defense mode. Which again, that's very quick. They kill like four people of color right off the bat, and we don't even care. Like, we're not told to care about them. It's so dismissive.
Yeah.
You know, but again, because of the needs of white people, because they want to be in this space, they want to invade this space, leaving these people unattended there with this creature. Mm-hmm. You know, but all the other times that he attacks are because he's attacked. You know, he's like, I'm just like, whoa, just staying here. And then, like, again, he's a creature. You know, they're positioning him as like something like lower evolved. You know, they bring this woman out there, and then he's like, well, she's cool looking. And then, like, you know, he just wants to be friendly. Although, again, that's where those sorts of conversations about sexual violence, you know, rape, all of that. That's like, what are we saving white women from, right, in these films? Mm-hmm. Like, what are we trying to stop? I think in horror noir, she said, like, what is too late? You know, we have to, like, extrapolate that out and think about, like, you know, murder, rape, you know, the sexual violence is implied very much in Creature from the Black Lagoon and a lot of these sorts of movies. You know, the film, like the posters for it all, it's like beautiful woman in the in the grips of a creature. That was actually really fun to read about with the Hays Code, because everybody was kind of upset when it would kind of come back and forth about the posters and about the images, because they were like, you're not going to like show this creature like having sex with this woman, are you? Like, they were very concerned about bestiality. So again, because it's the 50s, you know, they kind of pull back on some of that.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like, you know, they think of this creature as like, you know, a primitive life form, but like also at the same time, it's like the duality of that is that, you know, it's a primitive life form, but at the same time, it holds the key potentially to how we can discover other worlds and how life can begin. So it's not aware of its own profundity, right? Like it's, which like, those are things that I don't like. That's very colonizer. It's very white colonizer mentality. Decolonize the Gillman. Hashtag decolonize the Gillman.
No, but I mean, I think you're exactly right. Like that there is like, you know, like there's a whole conversation about that, about like what they could learn, you know, from traveling and, you know, like what it could mean to live elsewhere. And
yeah, we're going to be, what is it? Like, we're going to be in outer space soon. Like,
yeah,
when we go to other worlds, which is just like, which like for 1954 is like fantastic. To like all like, you know, just literally over a decade removed from like actual space flight and, well, actual landing on the moon. It's just right. Fascinating how, you know, it's speaking to that time of it, but also like from a science perspective, like also reveals like we, in order to understand the outside and things outside of our world, we often look to where we are right now. Which I thought was really from a, like, you know, trying to squeeze blood from a stone, you know, overcomplicate the films as we usually do here. I thought that was a really cool thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, I don't think that it like, again, you know, we talk about art, we're talking about reflections of society at the time, you know, so I really love this piece from, again, this is from Black Invisibility, White Science. That's the chapter in Horror Noir. And they're comparing the Gillman to King Kong and Gus from Birth of a Nation, rolled into one body. The monster resembles a racist caricature. Its lips are large and exaggerated, skin is dark, seemingly feeble-minded. I'm guessing they mean like in the sense that, you know, it's sort of tunnel visioned or, you know, the monster permits a counter image to white evolution, which is pictured as modern, intellectual, and civilized. That is, the film tells us that whites, with men at the top of the hierarchy, have evolved, while importantly, other races remain static and immobile in their progress. The film also speaks to where or among what places the exotic, dangerous Amazon, and which populations, the brown/black Brazilians, this is where inferiority can be located. When the monster meets its demise in its own territory at the hands of the white scientific elite, not only is its subordination assured, but it also becomes understood that such an other had no place in and could make no contribution to the white world, and that its mere presence, even its own non-white world, is a nuisance, a sort of white man's burden. You know, so that kind of goes with what we were talking about earlier and a little bit about what you're talking about evolution and, you know, like what belongs in modernity, what can be taken from you know, from like, you know, they're there to learn, but again, there's no like respect for like the space. I mean, again, even when they find the dude, you know, they want to kill him immediately, or at least Mark does. His whole thing becomes single-mindedly about murder and, you know, killing things.
Yeah.
The other thing that this book I think does a really interesting thing is that in 1955, Emmett Till was murdered. So just a year after this. So you take, you know, you have this film that seems to be, August of 1955. So about a year after, a little over a year after Creature from the Black Lagoon came out, you know, you have this horrible lynching. And so you see reflected in all of these films, like of the 50s, like, which again, this is white, like largely white men, you know, are crafting these films. You know, are writing them and are filming them or producing them and creating them. And so their whole like fear seems to be based in like, you know, the other, like people from outer space, the being a stand-in for communism, and then think monsters like King Kong, like Creech, like, you know, other, you know, monsters of that being like, you know, black and brown men as threats to white society. But then you have very much reflected in the news that no, the only fucking threat to society are you fucking white assholes coming in, beating us up and killing us and murdering us. You know, so there's a real interesting kind of interplay. And I think Creature from the Black Lagoon, one of the things I do really like about the film is I do think it does a good job of making the creature sympathetic. Like, yes, he's a monster. Yes, he takes, like, yeah, there are big problems with him wanting to, like, run off with this woman, you know, non-consensually. Yeah. You know, but it is a conversation about, like, I was minding my own business. Like, you all came here. And there's fighting even amongst the scientists, you know, because, like, David doesn't want to kill it. He tries to stop them. But, you know, Mark, like, you know, big science dude, he's kind of in a weird, we'll talk a little bit about the homoerotic tension between like them and with Kay and all that in a bit. But obviously, like, it feels like they just feels like he's reasserting his own like masculinity of like, well, I'm just going to kill it, you know, like, whatever, we're going to murder this thing. So again, I think it's an interesting space and time where it's like, yeah, very soon after this film came out, you know, where you, and at the end of it, they murder at least, you know, I mean, there are two sequels, but it looks like they succeed in killing him and he floats into the lagoon, which again, like, mirrors the attack on Emmett Till and what happened with him and his body being sunk in water and left there. And then, you know, they found it later and his mother famously, you know, put it on display because they wanted to see what she wanted the world to see, what white supremacy and racism did to her 14-year-old child. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures, but they're horrifying. And it's so sad. I know that's back in the news because I guess they found the arrest warrant for the woman who lied, like, because this whole death was a lie. I mean, like, it was predicated on a lie. So now people are calling for her to be arrested after all these years, which, yeah, I mean, whatever. I'm here for that. She should be punished in some way. I don't think she's ever done any real, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't speak on that. Any real apology or not, but anyways, it's just like, it's such a heavy film, you know, what we're talking about here, at least like reading, you know, when I first saw it, I liked it because I liked horror movies. I liked sea monsters. I like mermaids. Mm-hmm. I love Loch Ness Monster. Like, I'm here for that kind of stuff. So I always had an affinity for the Gillman because of that he was like a sea creature, and I just always thought he was like, the design on him is beautiful, again crediting Melissa Patrick and all, and the whole team that put that together. He's so cool looking. You know, these underwater sequences are beautiful. There were just part of me that's like, oh, I wish I was like some amphibious monster creature just living in this beautiful paradise. I mean, there are like moments of the film that are gorgeous. I know they built all this on a soundstage and whatnot, but I think they did a very nice job. It seems like heaven to me, you know, especially because there's lots of shade, you know, and little murky pits to float around in. But to get like horror noir and to get these readings of the film and to see how it was like resonating with Black viewers on a totally other level, you know, who saw this film for something else, even when it first came out, I think is quite incredible. Yeah. You know, it just adds like a heaviness to a film that, again, like, it, you know, barely over an hour long, and it's not too complicated. You know, scientists go to place, find monster, try to kill monster. There you go. I mean, it's a really simple story, but it has a lot of really cool elements to it. Were you going to say something before I moved on from that?
No, let's get to the gay shit.
Okay. Well, no, I don't want to like make it seem like it's that big of a deal, but I just, again, I love that in looking through all the books and stuff, like, I kept finding like different really cool readings of it. Creepy Bitches, I love this collection, has a whole thing called Taking the Ick Out of Ick Theology, which dives into the feminism of the film and kind of what, and actually all of them. It looks at the whole, all three films and sort of positioning the creature and the women in each film and how their roles kind of echo each other in ways. So I highly recommend that. Obviously horror noir, but so in looking in Monsters in the Closet, Homosexuality in the Horror Film, this kind of looks more at, so it says that, closer look at The Creature from the Black Lagoon and its sequels reveals the exact form of the phallic urge which the monster represents, the male-male erotic tension contained within the homosocial triangle. So I think what this is sort of discusses is, you know, you have like the woman there. Hold on. Oh, that's it. So Ramon Navarro was originally supposed to play one of the doctor's roles, who was a queer person. So it would have added like a whole other thing. Anyway, so the idea is that they're there. The males are there to vie for the attentions of the female, along with the creature, usually, while hunting for the creature. The men are constantly linked with the creature, swimming around in the murky waters with him, sharing his lust for the female lead, and frequently serving as red herring shocks for coming into the frame suddenly while the creature is on the loose. We see that in this film where, you know, I think Mark reaches for David. One of the things they point out is the squirt gun that they use with this milky liquid that they're all is swimming around shooting at the creature. let's see. The homosocial worlds of scientists and sailors are skewed by the presence of a woman. This is what I was looking for. As one character in the first Creature film warns about the initial expedition, there's just one problem: going into unexplored territory with a woman. These lone women exist in the films to diffuse the homoerotic tension of the situation, but ironically, they more regularly draw attention to it. The women themselves are linked to the monstrous by the way of their femininity, and it is through their presence that the possibility of the triangle's male-male desire is filtered. In the first film, Mark, played by Richard Denning, gets rather bitchy when he sees rival David with the woman Kay. Remember, they have that whole thing about playing house and... you know, so he scorns the possible heterosexual couple, feminizing and domesticating threat that it represents to the buddy's all male world. Let's see. I mean, this just kind of goes on with all of this kind of looking at if Mark can kill or capture the creature, perhaps he can keep his own sexual urges under control. He actually stands in for the creature a few minutes later when in the lair, David is shocked when Mark reaches into the frame to grab him. Anyways, this goes on, but I thought you would enjoy a little bit of that reading. I was wondering what you picked up on in the queerness of.
I'm listening to you tell this, and I'm like, okay, yeah, that does make sense when you do it that way, right?
Right, applying like this academic to it.
But like upon like, you know, viewing it, I'm like, I did not pick that up at all. I also just felt like they were just like two cis white masculine, cis het white masculine to read any sort of queerness into it, anything outside of the monster itself.
Yeah, that's kind of how I thought. I mean, I found that I thought it was interesting. I thought I'd bring it up if people want to explore that more or analyze it. Because what some of the other books and some of the other articles I was reading did make references about like the queering of like the creature, and even like the thought of having like a sexual relationship with him is a queerness of its own, not necessarily bestial, but kind of, but like, you know, so there was some discussion of that. You know, I can't remember what book that might be further into that, the queer, the monsters in the closet.
Yeah.
Thing. But yeah, I kind of felt the same in watching it. Like there were things about that I thought were, you know, certainly at the time, you know, I mean, these guys in their little shorts doing their little thing, like there's definitely some like flesh on display for all eyes that might be watching it. I imagine, you know, young gay boys in the 50s watching this probably were, there's probably some confusion about like the creature and the men and the whole thing.
You know, the high-waisted swimming shorts.
Right. You know, but there's something to be said for kind of David is trying. I don't think any of these characters are necessarily coded as queer. It's more of just like, I think if anything, this film is more about like, if you want to go into those waters, like, you know, analyzing like toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. You know, because David is obviously like, I'm a scientist, like I'm here, like we should protect this thing and like find out what we can learn from it. We shouldn't be trying to murder it. And it may be the last of its kind. Like how, like why, you know, why do we have the right to do that? You know, so he's like kind of representing a different type of man, you know, who Kay has chosen as well. Like that's something also to be said about Kay, is like, she's not with the quote unquote bad dude, you know, she's with the good guy and, yeah. You know, is trying to, you know, trying to support that guy.
Yeah.
Not the asshole who's like murder and everybody.
And we're going to see that. Like we see that in films. Like I'm thinking about Matthew Broderick Godzilla, where he's very that, you know, I except a little more, not as like a little more nebbish and physically weak looking than in this film. But
yeah, no, definitely. There is some of that kind of, it's interesting. They're not really those kinds of stereotypical scientists in like the goofy glasses and, you know, looking, you know, like these are like ostensibly attractive men, you know, swimming around the Amazon. So I can see why some people would want to kind of pull a queerer reading from it. But I think the queerness really lies more in the creature's desire for Kay and, you know, kind of playing with that imagery and that otherness of like, actually reading in The Lady from the Black Lagoon, she compared herself to the creature in the sense of like being like a teenager, kind of feeling like, you know, ugly and unattractive and not knowing how to talk to people who you find attractive. So there was like that, like for her, like she had that kind of attachment to the creature in those moments. That it's a sadness.
Yeah, it's queer. Like, I love that. That's really beautiful. But there's also a queerness in the fact that like it's a desire that looks that by other people is being told as unnatural.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. If you look at it, you're like, no, what? That's weird. Like, cause even in Shape of Water, like in watching it, it's like, she want to be with the fish man. What? Like it's, you know, but it, again, exactly. Like that's how people look at us, you know, in our relationships or look at trans people or look at, you know, other queerness as like something alien, something bizarre and something that they don't understand, but, you know, again, has its own beauty as its own, has its own language. So anyways, man, this episode, we keep trying to say we're going to make our episode shorter and tighter and more controlled, and they just
keep rambling on.
I know. Me too. Look at this gorgeous version of the film. It's
Did you just pull all of your collectibles and books? They're all like scattered in front of you.
I did. You know, I have a Funko of him. You know, one thing that I regret not buying when it came out, and I should have, and I don't even know why I didn't, because now it's like $200, is the Living Dead doll version.
Oh.
So I really, really want one. And I have him on like, you know, shopping like lists in case he, by some miracle, goes down in price. But I do. I have like the Funko Pop. I was trying to find, when I was like 13 or 14, Universal did like a big relaunch all their stuff. And I had a cute little tiny Creature from the Black Lagoon keychain that I had like on my bag forever. And I know it's here somewhere in a box and I can't find it, but it's, I was trying to find it for this because I've had it for 20 years, 20 fucking 4 years. Jesus. Shoot me.
Since you were 5.
Right. Exactly. Since I was in utero. Anyways, yay, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Great start.
Yes, I'm actually very excited about the films that we're watching in this mix. I'm also very excited about the movies we're watching for the After Fright School special, which, again, if you are listening, you can be one of our Patreon subscribers and get lots of fun content. Oh, my gosh. I've gotten some good feedback so far. I think people enjoy listening to us talk about things that are that are not horror related necessarily.
I mean, I do.
Yeah.
All right.
All righty. Well, thank you as always. Please tell your friends about us. Spread the word. Spread the Fright School message. Joe.
Feel better, Joshua.
You too. Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.